Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, are we all going to die from Teflon? Is the non-stick coating on the pots and pans that you're using, or that they're using in the restaurant where they're scrambling your eggs, going to nuke you? Greg Conco of the Competitive Enterprise Institute thinks no. Greg is with the CEI. He's a senior fellow and director of food safety policy at CEI.org, their website. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on the show today.
You're welcome. PFOA, perfluoro... can you pronounce it?
Perfluorooctanoic acid.
Perfluorooctanoic acid. Thank you very much. We are finding now that perfluorooctanoic acid can be found in the blood of 90% of Americans. In one study testing 600 children, 96% of them had it in their bloodstream. It's been found that they use a variation of this, a variation of Teflon that's made with this stuff in the inside of microwave popcorn containers, and that it can be found in the oil and in the popcorn after they've been made in the microwave. Why do you say we shouldn't worry about this stuff? The EPA says it causes cancer.
Actually, what the EPA says is that it probably is a cancer at very high doses, and I think that's the real key. I don't think there's a big disagreement about what the science actually says. The question is, what does that mean for normal human exposures, and what does it mean for what we ought to do about the product? I think the real question here is that there is a real health issue as it relates to occupational exposure, and that's certainly something that I think manufacturers like DuPont that use PFOA ought to be concerned about. But the amount of the chemical that actually gets into consumers either through nonstick cookware or these consumer food packaging coatings and other products is so small as to be functionally inconsequential.
Greg, why, Competitive Enterprise Institute always seems to be coming to the defense of big corporations and polluters in the United States, and you know, I'm scratching my head here. The EPA says that DuPont has been covering up what they call important information about health effects and water supply pollution with regard to this chemical for over 20 years. This doesn't concern you, the fact that a big corporation is hiding this information from us?
Well, certainly that concerns me, and I'm very glad that EPA has levied a very substantial fine against DuPont. I'm not here to defend the corporation or its practices. What I'm here, though, to do is to argue about what it is we ought to be doing about what we know about the science. Again, I don't think there's any dispute about whether PFOA at very high exposures can cause cancer and probably some other toxic effects. In laboratory animals, it's been demonstrated. And there appears to be, even in occupational exposure, small level of health effects.
The question in other words, there's an association between people who are exposed to this stuff and getting cancer and dying from it.
At very high levels, that is, occupational exposure.
Right.
But isn't
that just a little deceptive, Greg? Because I'm assuming that if you're into the science enough, you realize that cancer doesn't occur at a systemic level; it occurs at a cellular level. One individual cell's genes get modified in a way, by virtue of assault. There's a variety of different things that can cause that assault that can damage that DNA, from radiation to irritation to exposure, in this case to PFOA. And that one individual cell then begins growing like crazy, and boom, you've got cancer. And so when we're talking about something that might be slightly carcinogenic versus massively carcinogenic, we're just talking about, probabilities and odds. But the bottom line is, if you've got something that the Dow has known for 20 years not only causes cancer, but is all over in our bloodstream. And by coincidence, in the last 30 years, we've gone from 1 in 4 Americans getting cancer at some point in their lifetime to now 1 in 3 Americans getting cancer at some point in their lifetime. Just it, although obviously, you know, cancer doesn't pop up with a little flag that says, hi, brought to you by Dow Chemical or any other company, not to pick on Dow, but or DuPont, excuse me. We're talking about DuPont here, not Dow. But, you know, isn't the, at a certain level, this whole discussion of, well, you know, it's a high levels is really a specious argument.
I think what you're saying is in part true. That is the relationship of cancer and cancer being caused at the cellular level. But you have to remember that most of the carcinogens to which we're exposed in the food supply or in the environment are naturally occurring ones. For example, there are 17 known carcinogens in a cup of coffee. They exist naturally. Mother Nature put them there.
Actually, a lot of those carcinogens that are in a cup of coffee are the consequence of the coffee having been roasted.
That's correct. But
so they're not there naturally. They're the result of human intervention.
Of the roasting. My point, though, Tom, is are you suggesting that we ban coffee?
Well, I'm suggesting that people who drink coffee are at a higher risk for cancer, and that's, you know, I suspect that's common knowledge. I've known that for 20 years.
I would doubt very seriously that that's common knowledge. It probably is also not common knowledge that 2 ounces of raw, uncooked potato has the carcinogenic potency of the EPA's safe level of dioxin exposure.
But we're talking about a chemical here that is so pervasive in the environment that it has shown up in 90% of our water supply. It's in the blood of 96% of our children, and the EPA is classifying it as a probable carcinogen. We can do without it. Why? I'm just curious why you're defending industry on this.
I'm not defending industry. I'm defending.
Why are you saying that? Well, am I misconstruing you as saying really we don't have all that much to worry about here?
No, I think that based on what we know about PFOA's carcinogenic potency, I think that the normal consumer exposure to the chemical being very, very small is something that we ought not worry about. There are much bigger health risks and much bigger other risks in our society that I think we ought to be spending more of our time worrying about.
Isn't that a little like saying we shouldn't worry about terrorism because the terrorists only killed 3,000 people, whereas lightning, you know, kills more, you know, smoking kills more people? I mean,
I think
you don't just simply dismiss something.
I think we ought to be worried more about things like cigarette smoking and about high glycemic foods in causing cancer.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with you on that, but why come out and be defending these chemicals that are used in the manufacture of fluoropolymers when they're not necessary?
Well, I disagree that they're not necessary.
Well, they're phasing them out.
No. I think you're misunderstanding. What the EPA has asked the companies to do and what they've agreed to do is to eliminate exposures, releases from plants. They have not agreed, and EPA has not asked them to eliminate the use of PFOA precisely because there is no substitute for PFOA in creating these kinds of products. Now, you might say that we don't need nonstick cookware. That's an argument that could be made, and it's not an unreasonable one. Nevertheless, I think the good that products like these have done for American consumers vastly outweighs any harm that the products will ever cause.
How so? I have never used nonstick cookware, and I've never had any problem cooking.
But hundreds of millions of Americans have and have benefited from the time savings.
And how many thousands of them might have died of cancer as a result of it? As you say, hundreds of millions of Americans used it. It's a very small ratio. So is it worth a few hundred people dying of cancer so that we can have nonstick cookware?
Well,
how many Americans is it worth dying of cancer?
I don't think hundreds of people have died. I think
Is it worth one person? What if it was your child?
I think if it was my child, I would be much more concerned about keeping him from other things, other much higher risks. And then I would rather have the extra time that the time-saving products like this give me so that I could spend with my family.
Getting to know them before they die of cancer. I know it sounds rough. We have just a few seconds left. We're talking with Greg Konko, CEI.org. Greg, why do you and the competitive enterprise do this work of going out and telling people that there's nothing to worry here?
I don't think we're saying that there's nothing at all to worry about. I think our mission
is... We got what you say, but why?
Our mission is to try to refocus people on things that matter so that we can advance...
Then why don't you sue the tobacco companies instead of coming on radio programs and talking about Teflon?
Well, because people are out there trying to get rid of Teflon.
I see. Okay. Well, good point. Greg Konko, he's a senior fellow and food safety and director of food safety policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. If you want to read more about it, the website www.cei.org. Greg, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Tom.
Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Day by day, I hear the voices rising.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartmann here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. It's interesting. You know, I have these conversations sometimes with these folks. Greetings to the folks in the chat room. And hello there to Andrea. I was just visiting in London, some of the folks that and my good friend Paul and Nigel and Louise in there. Say hi to her. It's you'd want to drop into the chat room, go to tomhartmann.com and click live chat. It'll get you in there. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Jamie in Mount Vernon, Washington, had a question about our last guest. Hey, Jamie.
Hi, Tom. It's an honor to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
This guy really got my dander up.
Okay.
It's frustrating to me when I hear people like this talking. I have a four-year-old, and I take my mothering responsibilities very strongly, and I've always investigated stuff that people take for granted. And I feel like some of the statements that he made, and I love that you asked him if it was your child, you know, what would you do? And the thing is this is one tiny thing. And there are so many things in our society right now that are toxic to us. We live in a big cauldron of chemistry, and they don't study how does all of this interact in our bodies. What is considered a toxic level? Are they studying how much the consumers are actually getting, you know, in the packaging and all that?
Right.
One thing that I know about this non-stick stuff is that it has a form of fluoride in it, which is it's not nature's fluoride. It's a toxic byproduct from the fertilizer industry.
Right, tetrafluoroethylene.
Yeah.
And monofluoric acetic acid. These are it can actually be lethal to human. In fact, here's this from the Sierra Club, Jamie. This is the Sierra Club's thing on Teflon, and they say, we contacted Rich Purdy, who is an environmental scientist at 3M for 19 years, now an organic farmer and activist working to curb the use of hazardous chemicals. Purdy says that when used correctly, never heated beyond a medium setting, Teflon itself does not pose a threat to human health. However, he says, people are always in a hurry. They heat up to high and then back off. And this is when the pan starts to smoke, you know. He says, when that happens, the polymers in the Teflon can break down and off-gas a nasty combination of dangerous chemicals. The Environmental Working Group reports that the surface temperature of a Teflon-coated pan heated on high for 8 minutes on a conventional stove can reach 750 degrees Fahrenheit. At that temperature, the pan can emit fumes that contain not only PFOA, which is what we were just talking about, but also tetrafluoroethylene, another known human or animal carcinogen, and monofluoroacetic acid, which can be lethal to humans in low doses. At 887 degrees, Teflon releases perfluoroisobutene, a chemical warfare agent. Canary and parrot owners have known for years that the fumes from nonstick surfaces heated to as little as 325 degrees can kill birds. DuPont acknowledges this fact on its website, although it asserts the danger threshold is at 500 degrees. And you just have to ask yourself, if that's the case, you know, why is anybody promoting this stuff other than to make a living, other than to make a profit?
Well, in addition to that, the fluoride, There's other forms of these fluorides that they're using. They're putting in the pharmaceutical drugs that we use, in the packaging that we use, not to mention our water. They don't use nature's fluoride in our water.
No, they use a byproduct from the manufacture of aluminum that used to be, they used to have a terrible problem disposing of the stuff because it's a toxic chemical, and so they discovered that they could add it to our water supply and charge for it instead of paying to get rid of it.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Yeah, and, it really is, yes.
And so my biggest concern is that generally when they do studies like this, they don't study nursing women, they don't study children. So what are the toxic effects for our children?
Yeah, and the bottom line for me is, you know, I'm not here to tell you that any of these particular corporations are nasty or criminal or whatever. They're not violating the law. The EPA is just figuring out what the dangers are, and in fact, DuPont has agreed to go along with making the changes. It's just you know, enough already on from you know on my
and
end.
We,
I mean, we do our shopping at the organic section of the store. Use stainless steel pans. I mean, it's very simple.
So, and I'm sorry, we need to adopt the precautionary principle.
Yes, yeah, well, as they do in Europe. In Europe, the precautionary principle, very straightforward, says if we don't know the danger of something, then until you can prove that it's safe, we don't use it. Thanks a lot for the call, Jamie. I appreciate it. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Good morning, Tom.
We have about a minute before we have to take a break, Gary. What's on your mind?
Oh, boy. Can I call back? Okay, all right.
Go for it.
Okay.
You can do it.
I certainly will. I certainly will go for it. If we spend, here's the frustrating part. If we spent just half the time on our country's real priorities vis-a-vis our democracy, we'd be a lot better off. We've gotten so cavalier in our country. What in the heck's going on here?
Compared to, you said if we spent that time on our real priorities.
If we spent just half the time on our priorities in our country,
yeah.
Whether Republican or Democrat, whatever you feel, on our priorities, our real priorities, we'd be a lot better off.
And what are those real priorities in your mind, Gary?
Well, pardon me?
And what are those real priorities
in your mind? Well, our democracies, obviously.
Uh-huh. You mean things like whether or not our vote is actually counted and whether or not we have national health care insurance
and
whether or not...
And deficits as far... Thank you. And deficits as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, there you go.
This also reminds me it's not enough to be busy. So are the ants. The real question for America is what are we busy about?
There you go. Well said. Gary, thank you very much. And to his credit, I got to say, Howard Dean is out there talking about this stuff and talking about it aggressively. I got to tell you what's going on with Alberto Gonzalez and his hearings. We'll talk about that right after this. It's 9:27. Or on the West Coast, 12:27.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Tell me what's wrong with this picture. First of all, we have pretty much a year ago right now. This was the end of January 2005 during his confirmation hearings for Attorney General. Alberto Gonzalez, having been sworn under oath, speaking with Senator Russ Feingold. Senator Feingold says, Judge Gonzalez, let me ask you a broader question. I'm asking you whether, in general, the president has the constitutional authority. Does he, at least in theory, have the authority to authorize violations of the criminal law under duly enacted statutes simply because he's the commander-in-chief? Does he have that power? Well, Gonzalez dances around the thing for a while, and finally he says, Senator, this president is not, it is not the policy or the agenda of this president to authorize actions that would be in contravention of our criminal statutes. In fact, however, at that exact moment in time, the president for 2 years had been breaking our criminal statutes in contravention of our criminal, had been breaking the law. So, you know, Feingold takes it a little deeper. And says, well, Judge Gonzalez, let me ask you a broader question. I'm asking you whether, in general, the president has the constitutional authority to authorize violations of criminal law. Senator, Mr. Gonzalez, in my judgment, you phrase it as sort of a hypothetical situation. I would have to know what is the national interest that the president would have to consider. What I'm saying is it's impossible to me, based on the question as you presented it to me, to answer that question. I can say is... is that there is a presumption of constitutionality with respect to any statute passed by Congress. I will take an oath to defend the statutes, and to the extent that there is a decision made to ignore a statute, I consider that a very significant decision. Now, keep in mind, he's saying this as Bush is, at that very moment, ignoring the law, ignoring a statute. He says, I consider that a very significant decision, and one that I would personally be involved with. I commit to you on that, and one we will take with a great deal of care and seriousness. Well, I suppose he's telling the truth, since he was the one who advised Bush to break the law. So sure, he was involved with it. And yes, he took it carefully and seriously. Then Feingold says, well, that sounds to me like the president still remains above the law. Mr. Gonzalez, no, sir. Senator Feingold, again, you know, if this is something where you take a good look at it, you give a presumption that the president ought to follow a law, that, you know, that's, to me, that's not good enough under our system of law. Mr. Gonzalez, Senator, if I might respond to that, the president is not above the law. Of course he's not above the law, but he has an obligation, too. See, there's a but in there. Whenever there's a but in there, you can kind of ignore everything that preceded it. Of course he's not above the law, but he has an obligation too. He takes an oath as well. And his oath, by the way, is to uphold the Constitution of the United States, not to protect the people of the United States. Bush keeps telling us what his job, my job is to protect the American people. I'm sorry, it's not. Your job is to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States. That's the oath you took. Anyhow, Gonzalez, back to Gonzalez's testimony, he says, and if Congress passes a law that is unconstitutional, there is a practice and a tradition recognized by presidents of both parties that he may decide not to enforce that law. Now, I think that would be, Feingold says, I recognize that, and I tried to make that distinction, Judge, between electing not to enforce as opposed to affirmatively telling people they can do certain things in contravention of the law. In other words, Gonzalez is saying if the president thinks the law is wrong, he can refuse to go along with it. But that's different from breaking it. So Feingold says, oh, wait a minute, are you saying that he can actually break a law that he thinks is wrong? Gonzalez, Senator, this president is not it is not the policy or the agenda of this president to authorize actions that would be in contravention of our criminal statutes. Feingold, finally, will you commit to notify Congress if the president makes this type of decision and not wait 2 years until a memo is leaked about it? Mr. Gonzalez, I will advise the Congress as soon as I reasonably can. Yes, sir. This was a year ago, and Gonzalez had been advising Bush for 3 years, going on 4 years, actually, to break the law. Well, it's got a few Republicans upset here. Republican Arlen Specter, on Meet the Press with Tim Russert. Tim Russert first asked him the question, Arlen Specter answers.
The administration says that they didn't need to, that they already had authority from Congress when back in October 2002, Congress voted an authorization to go to war against Iraq, and this is part of that war.
I believe that contention is very strained and unrealistic. The authorization for the use of force doesn't say anything about electronic surveillance. The issue was never raised with the Congress, and there is a specific statute on the books, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which says flatly that you can't undertake that kind of surveillance without a court order.
So, great! Here we have a Republican, Arlen Specter, Pennsylvania, finally standing up on his two hind feet and saying, yes, you can't break the law, I'm not going to allow it. And so he brings before the Senate Judiciary Committee Alberto Gonzalez, the guy who swore under oath a year earlier, that if the president was ignoring or breaking the law, he would notify Congress. That it was not the policy of Mr. Gonzalez or the president to violate the law. Swore it under oath. So now they bring him before the House or the Senate again, the Senate Judiciary Committee. And Arlen Specter, the chairman of the committee, being a good Republican, questioning a good Republican, says, just like when George W. Bush and Dick Cheney were questioned by the 9/11 Commission, we're not going to require them to tell the truth. They can say any old thing they want. They're not under oath. And the same thing for Gonzalez. We're not going to ask Gonzalez to raise his hand and swear that he's going to tell the truth. We're just going to ask him some questions, and he can say whatever he wants, and there won't be any punishment at all if he lies to Congress. And Russ Feingold says, no, I would like, you know, I would like to have some, I'd like to see the roll call on that. I want to know who voted for that. Inspector says, this is a lousy way to start a hearing. You could just see Arlen Specter. He's just, you know, at this point, I mean, he's got to be taking so much flack from Republicans for even holding this hearing. And yet at the same time, he's not going to be able to do anything serious. Here's what happened this morning.
The question is, should the ruling of the chair be upheld that Attorney General Gonzalez not be sworn? The ayes have it.
Mr. Chairman, I request to see the proxies given by the Republican senators.
Well, we can rephrase the question if there's any serious challenge of the proxies. This is really not a very good way to begin this hearing.
Yeah. So Senator Herb Cole lays this thing out today. Mr. Attorney General, if terrorists are operating in this country or people in this country are communicating with terrorists, and of course we must collect whatever information we have or that we can. To accomplish this, the administration has three options, as you know. First, it would have followed the current law, which most experts believe gives you all the authority you need to listen to these calls. Second, if you thought the law inadequate, you could have asked Congress to grant you additional authority. Third, the course you followed, conduct warrantless spying outside current law and without new authorization. You get that? I mean, this is a senator talking to Gonzalez saying, come on, you give us all these phony baloney excuses, we're not buying this stuff. As Judd Legum notes over at the Think Progress Board blog, Gonzalez describes the situation as a choice between following the law, that's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and protecting America. Cole helps demonstrate that's a false choice. I mean, this is the whole thing that Gonzalez is saying is we've got to protect America. Yeah, we've got to protect America. And poor Specter. I mean, poor Specter. To the extent that I can have pity on a Republican, and it's pushing it. but poor Specter, here he is. He is his own party, of course, won't let him put this guy under oath. And now he won't allow, get this, the testimony that I just read you where Gonzalez was lying to Feingold when he was under oath, that's an impeachable offense. That is a high crime or misdemeanor, lying to Congress while under oath. It's a crime. Bill Clinton got impeached for lying to a judge when he was under oath, or a grand jury or whatever it was. It wasn't even Congress. Lying to a Congress is about as high as you can get in terms of crimes. And so it exists on videotape. And the Democrats say, well, let's watch the videotape of Judge Gonzalez's confirmation testimony. Let's just watch the videotape of what he said. And Arlen Specter, being the guy who runs the show, says, nope, he's not going to allow that to happen. He's not going to allow the videotape of Bush lying about this program or Gonzalez lying about the program. He's not going to allow either one of them to be played. Not going to happen. Not before this committee. No siree, Bob. Ain't going to happen. I mean, isn't this just absolutely incredible? The George W. just, you know, going on. Oh, we don't need FISA warrants, but before that, he said, you know, when you're thinking FISA, you're thinking, or when you're thinking domestic spying, you're thinking wiretapping. We always get wiretaps. A year ago, I'll play the clip for you when we come back from the break. I mean, it's just incredible. By the way, coming up in the next hour, are we seeing the end of the Internet, one of our free speech zones? And Bev Harris is going to be with us from Black Box Voting, talking about what's the latest with these machines. In the third hour of our program, we're going to have on Alec Dubrow, the media coordinator for International Labor Communications Association, and also Mark Morano, the conservative from CNS News, and Mark Carlin, the editor of Buzzflash, going to have a debate right here on this program. 9:40, it's 45 minutes, Pat.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Some say they go into a place called Orient. bad. But I've heard that I'm on the road to purgatory, and I don't like the sound of that. I believe in love, and I live my life accordingly. But I choose to let the mystery be.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where we run rings around the right wing every single day, 5 days a week, 3 hours a day, right here. So glad to have you with us. Congressman Bernie Sanders, a regular on this program for over 2 years now. Every Friday he's been with us. Collapsed Sunday while attending the funeral of a Vermont National Guardsman killed last month in Iraq. He says he had the flu. So just to let you know, we've gotten a number of emails asking if Bernie's okay. Bernie's just fine. There's just this nasty flu going around, and he thought he could push through, that he could show up for that funeral. And you know, good on him. God bless him for showing up for the funeral. But the flu got him. And that happens. In all probability, though, I'm expecting he's going to be better, and he'll be back with us on Friday of this week. I want to thank, by the way, Peter B. Collins for filling in for me on Friday of last week so that I could take a quick trip over to the United Kingdom and catch up with some old friends and take care of a little bit of business. And I even gave a couple of speeches while I was there. So, interesting time. Again, this spectacle before the United States Senate. The Senate Judiciary Committee, the Republicans, taking a principled stand. Arlen Specter, the question is, should the ruling of the chair be upheld that Attorney General Gonzalez not be sworn in? Not be sworn in, right? And then they take the roll. Hatch, aye, Republican. Grassley, Republican, aye. In other words, don't sign him in. DeWine, Republican, aye. Graham, aye. Kyle, aye. Cornyn, aye. And then Specter says, by proxy, for Senator Brownback, aye, Senator Coburn. We've got enough votes already. Okay, so he's got these two proxies. In other words, two of the Republican senators are not there. And Specter says, but I can vote for them, and they're on our side, and so we don't have to swear this guy in. We don't have to guarantee that Alberto Gonzalez tells the truth to this committee. Now, Gonzalez is the chief law enforcement officer in the United States. Can you imagine if the FBI picked you up and they said, you know, we'd like to, you know, Martha Stewart, we'd like to ask you a few questions about your stock trades, but we're not going to put you under oath. If you lie to us, there's no penalty. Somehow I doubt that would happen. But, you know, that's his department, the Justice Department, but they decided. So anyhow, Specter says he thinks he's got enough votes with these proxies, and so then he polls the Democrats. Leahy, emphatically, no. Kennedy, no. Biden, no. Cole, no. Feinstein, no. Feingold, no. Specter, aye. The ayes have it. At which point Feingold says, prove it to me. Because without those proxies, you don't have it. He says, I request to see the proxies given by the Republican senators. Specter says, could you repeat that, Senator Feingold? Feingold, I request to see the proxies given by the Republican senators. Specter, the practice is to rely on the staffers. In other words, I don't have the proxy. I am just trusting what my staff person told me. He says, but without counting that vote, well, we can rephrase the question if there's any serious challenge to the proxies. This is not a very good way to begin the hearing. In other words, he's got other procedural methods that he can use to make sure that they don't actually have to put Gonzalez under oath. This, once again, here's the clip.
Well, the question is, should the ruling of the chair be upheld that Attorney General Gonzalez not be sworn? The ayes have it.
Mr. Chairman, I request to see the proxies given by the Republican senators.
Well, we can rephrase the question if there's any serious challenge of the proxies. This is really not a very good way to begin this hearing.
Yeah, no, it's not. Not putting a witness under oath is not a good way to begin a hearing, Senator Specter. And I hope your constituents are calling 1-888-355-3588 and letting you know that they would like to see Mr. Gonzalez under oath. And they would like to see him prosecuted if he is lying. By the way, Mr. Specter has ruled that the videotape of George W. Bush lying to us will not be allowed into evidence. This particular videotape right here.
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so.
Yeah, well, it turns out he was lying through his teeth when he said that. For several years, he had been chasing down terrorists and spying on unknown Democrats without a court order. And look at where it got us. Diana in Chicago, Illinois on the line. Hey, Diana, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
I love your show. Absolutely love it.
Thank you
so much for talking about these critical topics and for explaining in such succinct, clear ways what is really going on. And when you talk about it, you give examples of what you're saying, and then you go back and let people hear the whole thing for themselves. I think that you are the perfect teacher for this.
Well, thank you, Diana. I appreciate that.
I have serious concerns about the direction in which our country is going. I mean, any time that you can tap people's telephones, and certainly the phones of your opponents, without warrants, and when you can arrest people without cause and hold them in jail for years and years, as they have done with Padilla and others, and when you can refuse to disclose public information such as the voting ballots and tallies in Alaska, and when you have Ohio senators who are trying to create laws, House Number 3, I believe it is.
Yeah, they did create the law. They just passed it a couple of days ago. Diana, I absolutely agree with you. We have some really serious problems in this country, and that's why we all need to get politically active. And I'm sorry we're out of, you know, the program's over. We're out of time for this hour anyway, but I thank you for your call and your kind comments. It's great to hear from you. And I do agree. We do have serious problems, and the only way these problems are going to get solved right now is to throw the bums out. And I'm telling you, the bums are the Republicans, and I don't mean that in any partisan fashion. I mean, what has happened is that we have a party that has had a noble history at times in its past, and it's been hijacked by right-wing cranks and crooks. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back, my friends. Broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania. Welcome, by the way, to the folks at WHMP and all of the listeners, all of our new listeners at WHMP in Springfield, Massachusetts. So very pleased to be on your radio station starting today, our newest affiliate, and welcome. Greetings. Bev Harris is the executive director of Black Box Voting, Inc., an advocacy group opposed to electronic voting methods. She popularized the term black box voting and is the author of a book of the same title. Her website, blackboxvoting.org. She runs the ORG, blackboxvoting.org. Bev, welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Tom.
It's always great talking with you, Bev. And recently I read a piece that I think you wrote. If you didn't write, it was flying around through your website that caught my eye. You know, one of the plumbers under Richard Nixon was involved in this thing. You know, the guy who burglarized Daniel Ellsberg, who I know Dan Ellsberg and his Pentagon Papers guy and busted in his place. And this is a story worthy of, you know, the convoluted weirdness of the Kennedy assassination. Let's start out at the beginning. Who is Jeffrey Dean?
Jeffrey Dean is the guy who was programming almost every component of the system that later became Diebold Election System. And by every component, I mean not just the central tabulator stuff, but also the stuff that sorts your absentee ballots as they go out and as they come in, and also the stuff that captures the signatures off your absentee ballots. Really, every single facet of the election systems, he was a programmer and deeply involved. What was interesting is we found out he started doing this while he was in prison. Not after he got out, but while he was still in prison, he was working with King County Elections to develop software for them. And as we started tracing it more, now what he was in prison for was 23 felony counts of computer fraud.
Whoa, now hang on just a second. Which, by the way, I suppose our quote for the day should be Joe Stalin's, you know, it's attributed to him. Nobody knows if he actually said it or not. But, you know, those who vote decide nothing. Those who count the votes decide everything. You're saying that the guy, Jeff Dean, the guy who wrote the initial Diebold software, had been convicted of 23 felonies involving computer fraud. Now,
correct.
If I was Diebold, I suppose, on the one hand, I'd be saying to myself, or if I was an executive there, I'd be saying to myself, you know, this could be a public relations nightmare. On the other hand, I might be saying to myself, you want a guy who knows how to create hack-proof software, hire a hacker.
Well, you know, that's been said. And so that's one of the reasons we thought we should find out a little bit more about this guy and how much he had reformed. He actually went back to prison in 2004. He went back to prison for making false claims to the court, and he's been in and out of
trouble. Hasn't reformed that much, huh?
Yeah, so I have to say that it doesn't necessarily look like he's wearing the white hat.
Is he in prison right now?
No, he was in prison for about 5 months in 2004.
I see. And was he working for Diebold at the time?
That is what we're trying to find out. He was working for Diebold as a consultant on and off. Now, one of the other things we've done, we've pulled about 3,000 pages of documents on him, and we're going to be posting the transcripts of a recent trial online today. And that'll be right at the top right side of our website. We haven't
at blackboxvoting.org.
At blackboxvoting.org. I haven't even read all of the latest 1,000 pages, so, you know, we can all read through it together. But at any rate, we wanted to find out the extent to which, first of all, the stuff that he wrote is still being used, because nobody really knows. Because, of course, even if you leave the company, if you wrote the stuff and no one changed it, then it's your stuff. And we also wanted to find out if he's still been paid by Diebold. Now, in the transcript of a deposition, a bankruptcy trustee was asking him, have you ever, are you still, and are you in the future going to be receiving payments from Diebold? And he would not answer that question. So that does raise a lot of red flags.
Now, why on earth would a reputable company, I mean, Diebold, for all the failings of their machines and everything else, I mean, you know, it's a company. They're in business to make money. Wally O'Dell and his statements about how he's going to bring Ohio for George W. Bush aside, I really think that that was an inopportune statement that he made. I mean, you know, he was a Republican. He lived in Ohio. He was in charge of the or part of the reelect Bush campaign committee. I don't think in his wildest dreams he meant we're gonna hack the machines in Ohio and steal it for George. He was just saying what a good Republican says. Why would a company? And this is not. And frankly, you know, this is where I guess I put my tinfoil hat on. My personal take on it, and tell me if you think I'm crazy on this, my personal take on it is that none of these companies, ES&S, Sequoia, Diebold, none of them as a company, as an institution, would ever be involved in vote hacking or vote rigging. But that it's very likely, in fact, I think it's been done. I think it was done in particular in Georgia when Saxby Chambliss got so-called elected, when all the polls showed that Max Cleland won by the exact margin
right.
that Saxby Chambliss won by, with no paper trail whatsoever. I think it's entirely probable that these companies have, by virtue of incompetence or whatever, created machines that are easily hacked. I mean, we just saw that in Leon County, Florida.
Correct. Yeah, and it's interesting because you bring up Georgia. One of the specific time periods when Jeffrey Dean says he was specifically brought back by Diebold to work on problems in the system was during the time that there's a program called Rob Georgia that was in a file that said replace the Georgia voting system with this. During the time that was created, because you can see the date stamps on the file, what happens to be the time that Jeffrey Dean says he was brought back by Diebold to do consulting. So there again, we have to look at this. We can't, you know, I'm not speculating on motivation, but you cannot just say, oh, well, it couldn't be anything unless you go out and check, because we don't know the extent to which the software is still available. We also found from a recent court transcript from Jeffrey Dean himself that he made remote access. And by that I mean he was in Washington State and he accessed several California county election systems in the 2000 election.
So he had built a backdoor into the software in the first place that he could later access?
You know, it was supposed to be for a benign reason. He was trying to transfer data back and forth for some kind of a program he was building.
You mean data like votes for Arnold?
Well, it was called Vote Remote.
Yeah.
So there he was in Washington, up in the Seattle area, in a office where he had Mount Lake Terrace is what it was. It was a suburb of Seattle. And he testifies that he spent weeks in California. He named some of the counties, and some of them were Los Angeles County, Alameda County. And he says he was working on basically getting remote access so that he could transfer data back and forth. You know, this is why black box voting is in business. Because whether or not something happens, what we do know absolutely is that this is a breakdown in the people and procedures defense.
Right. You don't want to have, in other words, whether or not somebody has hacked these, in this case, Diebold machines, and this is certainly not unique to Diebold.
Right.
Whether or not somebody has hacked these machines, whether or not Jeffrey Dean or anybody else did it, the fact of the matter is that they're designed in such a way that they're accessible, and the proof of it is that this guy's accessing them from 1,000 miles away.
Right. That's exactly the point. And if you can have a situation, which we know it to be the case now, where you have a convicted felon who specializes in computer crime, who has accessed by remote access live county election systems during an election process, whether or not he did anything bad, you have a breakdown in security. And that's the kind of thing, in the constructive sense, that we need to do, is we need to identify that these things have happened and then say, what can we do to prevent this kind of stuff from happening in the future?
Incredible. Do we happen to know if Jeffrey Dean has any political affiliation or past history in politics?
We don't know that, but as you pointed out, the law firm he was involved with when he had his issue that sent him to prison, which he says he was a scapegoat for, was very politically active. Both parties were involved, but it represented King County, and it also had, as you pointed out, one of the Watergate guys.
Eagle Crow.
He went by Bud Crow.
Yeah.
And he was the guy who ordered the break-in for Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. He was a partner in the law firm at the time Jeffrey Dean was there. Cyrus Vance's son, former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance's son, also worked there. It was a very politically connected law firm, but that doesn't mean that Jeffrey Dean had any particular political
preference. So one more example of just the incredible mess we have here, and the question we have to ask ourselves, Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.org, is why? Why on God's earth, why would any politician think that it was appropriate to privatize our vote? It's just insane. Of all the things that should never be handed over to private for-profit corporations, you know, even if they privatized Yellowstone, it wouldn't be as big a crime as privatizing our vote, and they are doing it all across this country. Bev Harris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.org. Check it out. Check it out once a week, in fact, for sure, and see what's going on. We'll talk to you soon. 16 minutes.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. Yes, indeed. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception, the place where despair is not an option. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. 21 minutes past the hour. This hour, one of the questions we're going to ask, are we seeing the end of the Internet? One of our free speech zones. This administration, hell-bent for leather on destroying all of our free speech zones as quickly and aggressively as they can. But first, we've got a Rush Alert.
With condescending crimes, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts. I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud, can you dig it? I'm sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic, cuts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi, he's a Nazi.
Yes, it's time for our Rush Alert. Well, how do you cause people to think that a birth control pill is actually an abortion pill? Well, you suggest that people who take it are already pregnant. Sort of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, this is the, I'm telling you, the agenda of the so-called anti-abortion right is actually an anti-woman right, and their agenda goes beyond abortion. They are opposed to birth control pills as well. Plan B is a birth control pill. RU486 is an abortion pill. RU486 is a pill that you can take during the first month of pregnancy that causes an abortion. But the way it works is, the way that people get pregnant is it takes up to 3 days after intercourse for that sperm to work its way all the way up into the fallopian tubes where it has to, which is where the egg is hanging out, where it fertilizes that egg. And Plan B prevents fertilization from happening. It's just a high dose of birth control. It's a high dose birth control pill. It's just a birth control pill. So, but if you want to suck up to the anti-abortion, anti-birth control, anti-woman crowd, you say...
The most dangerous place you can be is between a liberal woman and her morning after pill. A liberal woman gets pregnant, you do not want to be anywhere near her morning after pill.
Yeah, so there you go. Morning after pill for somebody who gets pregnant. Sorry, it's not how it works, except in Limbaugh land.
In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the couple. The cop of Joe McCarthy, like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-of-the-mouth, jack-booted slob, the democratic trasher. Years of liberal bashing with the equivalent compassion of a grommet. With the IQ of a pig, I'm the fat, obnoxious pig. And the truth of the matter is, I'm vomit.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Yes, sorry I'm a bit late. I've been trying to get to a phone.
That's quite all right. You're reporting today from Washington, D.C.?
I am. I've just been to the White House briefing. Prior to that, I was at the NSA spying hearings on Capitol Hill.
That was an entertaining little row. Mr. Spector trying to weasel out of swearing in Mr. Gonzalez.
It was great stuff. We just needed our popcorn, but they won't let you eat in the hearing room.
Yeah.
A couple of...
It really is just a show, though, isn't it, Victoria? Nothing's going to come out of this. I mean, this guy has committed a crime. He lied before Congress during his hearings a year ago, his confirmation hearings, when he said that he would never never allow a president to break the law. He would notify Congress if the president was spying on people without warrants. And here now, Spector refuses to allow him to be put under oath, so he can't be prosecuted.
Well, you see, I don't know whether even when things come out during these hearings and the senators want to do something, whether it'll make any difference anyway, because the White House doesn't really view itself as being under their purview at this point. So I'm not sure anything will happen. But, I mean, it's just useful perhaps for the American people to see firsthand what the administration has to say about this.
Yeah. Well, what they have to say about it is laws. We don't need no stinking laws.
Right. Right. Senator Kennedy had an interesting point when they were discussing FISA back in the 70s and when it was put together. Of course, Kennedy was in Congress back then. And Alberto Gonzalez said, you know, it was a different time. And, you know, we were facing a different kind of threat. And Kennedy came back with what I thought was rather an interesting point. He said, yes, that was a nuclear threat. We were in the height of the Cold War.
Yeah, a little more serious threat. And then you get these guys who say, well, you know, we have terrorists on our shores. That has changed everything. They may be among us, you know. And I say, hey, wait a minute. Don't you remember that during the War of 1812, the British not only were among us, but they marched into Washington, D.C. and burned down the White House?
Right.
And we didn't have to suspend the Fourth Amendment for that. And, you know, with respect and apologies to you and your accent. You know,
that's all right. Thank God I wasn't around then.
There you go. And so, anyway, it's so what else is happening in Washington, D.C. today, Victoria?
Well, the main thing is that the budget's coming out today, and there's all kinds of budget briefings, most of which I frankly don't understand, but the upshot of it is that defense does well, and, you know, poor women and children are not going to do too well. That's basically the upshot of it.
Right, and millionaires and billionaires are going to get more tax cuts.
They will do quite well out of this. I mean, it's kind of what you might expect to come out of this budget, although the Republicans claim that they're committed to cutting the deficit in half, and that the budget takes that into account.
Yeah, cutting it in half from the funny numbers that they gave last time when they were saying that this is, it's like the store that doubles their price so that next week they can have a half price sale. It's incredible. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria, for being with us today. Always great to hear from you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Robin Bush and his merry band ripped apart this happy land. It's Robin Hood with a switch. He steals from the poor and gives to the rich. The Bushies and the Foxies and the prehistoric limbo.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A place where you can receive your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to our program. Is it the end of the Internet we're looking at? I just want to share this with you briefly. Verizon, Comcast, Bell South, and other communications giants are developing strategies that would track and store information on our every move in cyberspace. This according to an article by Jeff Chester. In a vast data collection and marketing system, the scope of which could rival the National Security Administration, he says the nation's largest telephones and cable companies crafting an alarming set of strategies that would transform the free, open, and non-discriminatory Internet of today to a privately run and branded service that would charge a fee for virtually everything we do online. Why? Are they doing it because they want to be Big Brother, because they want to know everything about us? No, they're doing it because they want to make money. Very simple. Let's make some bucks. I remember years ago, I used to run forums for CompuServe, and I was in a meeting in Columbus, Ohio, with a bunch of CompuServe executives. This must have been 10, 12 years ago. And about the time the Internet was really starting to take off, and there was a discussion about how they had figured out that with the type of switching equipment that they have, if you were to ask for a particular website, they had the ability with particular IP addresses with a particular website to slow down access to it. So, for example, if they wanted you to use the CompuServe search engine and you were to type in the Google search engine or the Yahoo search engine instead, they could throw a tenth of a second or a half a second or a 1 second pause into there. So all the other search engines would seem to be slow. And there was a debate about whether or not this should be done. You know, this would be a good business practice, but is it right? And ultimately, they decided not to do it, at least to the best of my knowledge. I mean, the meeting that I was in on, they decided not to do it. But that technology has been around for well over a decade to control the ability to access websites and the speed with which you can access websites. And so now what they're talking about is taking this a step further. First of all, they're saying that, we've got this spam problem. We'll solve the spam problem by saying that if you have paid us, then your email comes into our members. At least so far, this proposal being put forward by AOL and I believe Verizon, that if you pay us, then your email comes in and goes around the spam servers. The spam filters, AOL and Yahoo, excuse me. They will still accept email. This from a piece in the New York Times by Saul Hensel. AOL and Yahoo will still accept email from senders who have not paid, but the paid messages will be given special treatment. On AOL, for example, they will go straight to users' main mailboxes and will not have to pass the gauntlet of spam filters. So if you're a spammer, you just pay them, right? Very simple. Or if you're you or me, you just pay them. And I frankly look at this as, an excuse. Spam is a great excuse to increase profit. Now, I mean, this is something we've struggled with, those of us who've been online forever, and I've been online since before there was an Internet, back when it was 300-baud auditory modem hookup on CompuServe. And the big database was LexisNexis, and that was it. And you know, how do you deal with spam? How do you deal with unwanted email? And one proposal that has always made a certain amount of sense to me, although I know that it's blasphemous to say it in Internet circles, is to turn the SMTP servers over to the post offices of various nations and just, you know, every time you send an email, you pay, say, a hundredth of a cent. And so, you know, at the end of the year or at the end of the month, I may end up, so, you know, say I send, you know, 20, 30 emails a day. At the end of the month, I may owe $5. Okay. You know, it's still cheaper than mail. It's cheaper than postage. But if I'm a spammer and I want to send out a million pieces of email, it's going to cost me more than $5. The problem is that there's no good way to enforce this, and there's no clean way around it, because somebody can still in the Ukraine, you know, use a server or something like that and spam folks out. So anyhow, there's that suggestion out there, and that's why I say I think that this is just all about money. And the other one is that this back to Jeff Chester's article, phone and cable lobbyists are now engaged in a political campaign to further weaken the nation's communications policy laws. They want the federal government to permit them to operate internet and other digital communication services such as private networks free of policy safeguards or governmental oversight. In other words, they want to be able to say, oh, you're using a lot of bandwidth, we're going to charge you for that. Or you're sending a lot of bandwidth, we're going to charge you for that. Now, some ISPs are already doing this, but we're talking about, you know, just really making this a system-wide thing, really instituting it. And those web companies, those companies that are providing web content that are paying into the system, their stuff gets through a little magically more fast than others. It's going to be really interesting to see how much longer the Internet stays relatively free and open, because I smell big. You know, I mean, we're talking a multi-billion-dollar company industry here. I smell big corporations sniffing around big time, and there is money to be made, my friends. Money to be made. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bill in Long Island on the line. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
How you doing? Let's see, I just got off the phone, well, a little bit while ago with all inspectors' office, and I think I'll call in and let you know what they said.
Yeah, what happened?
All right, I'd asked them two questions. The first one I said is I want to know why they didn't swear in Gonzales and why they weren't allowing the footage in. They answered the first question by saying that they felt that they didn't have to swear in Alberto Gonzales because he was the attorney general, and they felt that that constituted being sworn in.
Hmm.
And then as far as the answer...
So what's the danger of the redundancy? You mean if you swear them in twice, then that reverses it or something?
I have no idea, but they were kind of agitated, and they never even answered the second question and had to hurry up and take more calls.
I see.
But yeah. They were being slammed, though, at this point, I would say, because it took several attempts to get through, and the line was always busy. So obviously other people are calling in to go, what's up?
Yeah. Well, I think people also need to call in and support Specter in as much as, now this is sort of, you know, kind of backdoor, but the toll-free number, of course, is 888-355-3588. And call in and say something to the effect of, I support Senator Specter in getting to the bottom of this Bush administration's breaking the law.
Excellent.
And
yeah.
And that might actually cause Specter to actually do something, because what I think is happening right now, frankly, is 5% Specter being righteously indignant about what he knows is wrong, and 95% Specter being the point man for a party that wants to appear like they're taking care of ethical and legal lapses, but really has no intention of doing so.
Yeah, I agree. And just by the way that the call handlers are handling things, I think they're probably getting more negative comment than positive.
Yeah, and what we need to do is encourage them to dig a little deeper. And I mean, just the fact that they're holding the hearings and they're letting Democrats question a witness, that's a big deal in and of itself. It's just that, you know, tragically, it's unlikely that anything will ever come of it because the Republicans are running the thing. But
yeah,
we'll see.
Start in the right direction.
Yeah, good on you, Bill, though, for calling our inspector's office. Congratulations. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good day, Tom.
Yeah, good talking with you. Jake in Arcata, California, KGOE. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
I am great, but I'll get better.
Like you, I can't believe that they let this lying attorney general, Mr. Torture Memo, Alberto Gonzalez, get up there and lie and say the president has constitutional precedent for this.
Well, he's not under oath.
Yeah, no, he's
up there. He can say anything he wants.
He's up there lying. The Supreme Court has never upheld warrantless wiretapping in this country.
No.
They never have, and the Republicans are lying about it. Bush is doing a totally illegal domestic surveillance operation, and he should be impeached for it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. And, in fact, the United States Supreme Court, in a case back in the 70s that had to do with Richard Nixon, came right out and said, No, it's not legal to do wiretapping. In fact, this is called United States versus United States Eastern District. U.S. Eastern District Court of Michigan et al. 407 U.S. 297, 1972. And Justice Lewis Powell, who was a conservative on the Supreme Court, ruled, and I quote, "History abundantly documents the tendency of government, however benevolent and benign its motives, to view with suspicion those who most fervently dispute its policies. Fourth Amendment protections become the more necessary when the targets of official surveillance may be those suspected of unorthodoxy in their political beliefs. The danger of political dissent is acute when the government attempts to act under so vague a concept as the power to protect domestic security. The price of lawful public dissent must not be a dread of subjection to an unchecked surveillance power, nor must the fear of unauthorized official eavesdropping deter vigorous citizen dissent and discussion of government action in private conversation. For private dissent, no less than open public discourse, is essential to our free society." End of quote. It's Justice Lewis Powell speaking for the Supreme Court in 1972, saying that Richard Nixon didn't have the right to wiretap people without a warrant. I mean, this has already been decided by the Supreme Court. George W. Bush committed a high crime and a misdemeanor. He committed a crime. It's just very simple.
Absolutely, Tom. It's we need a special prosecutor because we can't rely on, you know, the Republicans to investigate Bush. We need a special prosecutor to look into what's really going on behind this domestic surveillance, because if they were really going after terrorists, they could have gone to FISA. There's no reason the court would not have granted their warrants.
Yeah, the question in my mind, absolutely, Jake, I absolutely agree with you. The question in my mind is, what Democrats were they listening in on that they were so afraid that they knew that a judge would say, no, you can't have a warrant for that? I mean, we already know that Alan Greenspan's wife, Andrea Mitchell, you know, a high mucky muck with NBC, has asked Jim Risen, the guy who broke this story, who wrote the Bush, who wrote the book about Bush doing this, has asked him whether or not Christiane Amanpour was being spied upon. Well, her husband, Jamie Rubin, was way up in the Kerry campaign. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Indeed, 9.5 minutes before the hour, Alberto Gonzalez testifying before Congress. Senator Dianne Feinstein, hearkening back to George W. Bush's speech of a year ago, April.
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so.
And we know now that when George W. Bush said that, he was lying through his teeth, that for 2 years he had been wiretapping people without a court order, and we still don't know who he was wiretapping, which Democrats it was, whether or not he was wiretapping Democratic senators in their offices. We do know that people operating out of the office of Senator Bill Frist were breaking into the computers of Ted Kennedy and hacking that computer. We know that, and there's been no investigation because the Republicans won't allow that. Well, anyhow, here's what Dianne Feinstein, she's asking Alberto Gonzalez about this, and Alberto Gonzalez's response, it sounds a little bit like Jeff Gannon, but it's Alberto Gonzalez.
That the President of the United States in Buffalo, New York in 2004 would say, and I quote,
"This is Feinstein.
Anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, it requires... A wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so. Mr. Attorney General, in light of what you and the President have said in the past month, this statement appears to be false. Do you agree?"
Yeah, and now Gonzalez is going to go through a whole bunch of weasel words, and at the very end he's going to wrap it up by saying the President's not a lawyer. In other words, because he's not a lawyer, you can't expect him to tell the truth.
No, I don't, Senator. With your suggestion that somehow the President of the United States was not being totally forthcoming with the American people, I have his statement. he was referring to roving wiretaps. And so I think anyone who...
So you're saying that statement only relates to roving wiretaps?
Senator, that speech was about, that was a discussion was about the Patriot Act. And right before he uttered those words that you're referring to, he said, secondly, there are such things as roving wiretaps. You know, now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretaps, it requires a wiretap, requires a court order. So, as you know, the president is not a lawyer.
As you know, the president is not a lawyer. There you go. Oh, my. Dick in Ohio. Hey, Dick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. Dick, what's on your mind?
You made a good point, Tom, about the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't want to see it taken over by corporations, you know.
Yeah.
I use it for valuable research, you know, Yahoo and looking up things, but let's don't have corporate America take over our Internet.
I agree.
Have a good day.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you, Dick. John in Turtle Creek, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
Hey, I just wanted to, I don't want to change the subject on you, but I wanted to touch base on the Super Bowl yesterday and how ABC made promos, which were lead-ins from commercials. And they were a retrospect. They went back to a year of the Super Bowl, and they showed some of the history of that year. But what was disturbing to me was that at one of the promos, they showed President Clinton making the comment that he did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that they showed it once. I guess they didn't have enough lead-ins made, and they repeated them. They made sure they repeated that one again.
Yeah. That and, you know, there's a new Ad Council ad out that says, do you know what would you, have you informed your child what to do in the event of a terrorist attack? And I'm like, come on. I mean, have you informed your child what to do in case your house gets hit by lightning or there's a hurricane or there's a tornado or there's a... But no, it's a terrorist attack. Be afraid. Be very afraid. This reminds me of in the 50s when I was a kid in school, we'd have to, you know, the bell would go off and we'd dive under our tables and cover our eyes and put our thumbs in our ears so our eardrums wouldn't get blown out when the nuclear blast went off. It's duck and cover. It's be afraid. Be very afraid all over again. Tom, thanks a lot, John, for the call. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Yeah, why don't, when Bush says the United States, why does he say United States? What is that about?
It's about him trying to sound like a good old boy. I mean, here's a kid who grew up, he spent his life in prep schools in Andover, Massachusetts, is where he grew up.
Right.
Then he went to college at Yale, then he went to college at Harvard, and then he went back to Texas and got drunk a lot and picked up a Texas accent, sort of a Texas accent. We've had a number of people on this program from Texas saying that it's not really a Texas accent.
They don't say United States, right?
Yeah. No, they don't, no.
But I wanted to mention on Friday, Peter Beard...
Could be Warnicki-Korsakoff syndrome, too, just, you know, alcoholic brain damage.
Right. Your guest host, Peter B., ran into one of your con callers, the guy that always says John Forbes Hines carries.
Oh, yeah, Wit. Good old Wit.
Yeah. And he was mentioning how Cindy Sheehan was embracing Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and why do you liberals like to embrace that socialist? I'm looking right here at my Britannica Almanac, and it describes Venezuela's form of government as a federal republic, the same as America's.
It's a democracy, and Chavez was elected by a majority of the people, twice,
yeah, right.
As a matter of fact.
Consolidating power, but isn't George Bush also consolidating power?
Here's where Chavez is a socialist. In this guy's mind, no doubt.
Right.
The oil company in Venezuela owns the oil that's under the ground, and when they pump that oil and sell it to us, they use the profit, some of the profit, to pay for food, housing, and medical care for poor people.
Yeah,
and that's just intolerable. That's
right.
Just intolerable for conservatives. They think
right.
that when Jesus talked about that stuff in Matthew 25, that he was just being weird. That when he talked about it in the Sermon on the Mount, he was just being weird. When Maimonides talked about it, when in the old prophets in the Old Testament, in the Old Testament talked about it, in the Quran when they talked about it, when Buddha talked about it, when the Hindu sages talked about it, that they're all just being weird. You know, don't you know it's every man for himself? Don't you know greed is good? You know, otherwise he's a socialist. How dare he take care of the poor people? And he's just buying their votes. Don't you get it? Well, you see, in a representative democracy, you're supposed to vote for the people who do what you want. And if he's doing what they want, they vote for him. But, no, we can't have that. 57 minutes past the hour. Thanks a lot for the call, Tom. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, for clean elections, anyway. You know, clean air, and a good educational system, and national health care for all, and stronger labor unions, and, you know, stuff like that. Yeah, okay, we fiendishly plot for that. By the way, at the bottom of the hour, for our best of the rest of the news segment, usually we get a couple of folks from two different progressive websites to share with us their thoughts on what's in the news and what's coming up in the news. This week we're going to try something different. We're going to have Mark Morano, the senior conservative writer for CNS News, what used to be called the Conservative News Service, now Consortium News Service, and Mark Carlin, the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com, one of the best progressive websites, and we're going to let these guys have it out. But right now we have Alec Dubrow with us. Alec is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org. Hey, Alec.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am absolutely great. I was in London over the weekend. I had a marvelous time, saw some good friends, and it was a quick trip, and got abused by United Airlines, but I'm back.
Great. I guess you noticed they drive on the other side of the road there.
Yeah, I've known that for some years.
I'm going to try to segue this into talking about industrial accidents.
Okay.
And the day I got to London, I crossed the road looking the wrong way and came about that close to being killed, but I made it.
Yeah.
Mine safety is all in the news now.
Yeah, now I have noticed, Alec, that there was a group of miners in Canada who went to a safe room
when their
mine caught on fire. And in a follow-up story, two follow-up stories actually that I read. One pointed out that all the mines in Canada have safe rooms, and the other pointed out that this is a result of government regulations, which were pushed by the mine unions.
Exactly.
And that most of the miners are unionized. And I also note at the same time that George W. Bush is in the process of getting passed through the Senate the confirmation of his newest member of our federal mine safety agency, a former head of a mining company.
Uh-huh. How interesting. How unusual.
How sick and twisted. I mean, it's like, and we had two more miners die last week. I mean, we can kind of joke about the irony of it all, but people are dying.
People are dying. And one of the things to keep in mind here is that mine accidents are like plane crashes in that they're among the very few industrial accidents in which a large number of people can be killed at once.
Mm-hmm.
And they involve drama, and they involve possible rescues. And so they're good news. I mean, not good news, but it's newsworthy.
Right.
Of the nearly 6,000 industrial fatalities each year, most of those occur one or two at a time, and they go unnoticed, kind of like car accidents. But they are, in fact, the real meat of this issue.
Yeah, I thought that was something like, isn't there something like 50,000 people a year die in the workplace in the United States?
No. I said between 5,000 and 6,000.
5,000 and 6,000. Okay,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's the number of injuries, though, is probably over a million.
Yeah.
And I talk about this as if it happened to somebody else. I remember when I was a kid, I had an industrial accident. I was working at a grocery store, and a soda bottle exploded and cut off part of my finger.
Hmm.
And in those days, they thought they were doing me a favor by paying the hospital bill.
Hmm.
The next day, they said I could take the day off, but I wouldn't get paid.
Right.
So that's,
I take it you didn't have a union, Alec.
I didn't have a union, my God. We did have minimum wage, and believe me, I got it. But the truth is, of course, as you point out, that the more unions you have, the more health and safety or more effective health and safety laws you have. And on the federal level, it's so fascinating that the first, as far as I know, the first piece of legislation that George Bush signed into law when he became president was the overturning the rule on ergonomics.
Mm-hmm. So that people who have carpal tunnel syndrome as a result of you know, a workplace injury can
right.
no longer claim workers' compensation and can no longer, you know, get time off and get therapy and all those kinds of things.
Well, it certainly weakened it. And,
yeah.
and here's an interesting part, too, is that it removed from OSHA the mandate to investigate them. But a lot of the people at OSHA are good people, and they found a way to pursue, you know, egregious repetitive stress things through their general purview. In other words, they still look at these things. So we still have some statistics on them, and it's fascinating. One-third of the injuries, of the industrial injuries, are repetitive stress. And the worst of it occurs in the meatpacking plants, mm-hmm. which surprisingly have gone from unionized to almost entirely immigrant and in many cases undocumented laborers who can't file a grievance, who can't even complain without endangering their status in the country.
Right.
Now, I don't want to get off into the issue of illegal immigration, but the truth is that they are picking the people who are most vulnerable, least likely to complain, and putting them in the most dangerous industries a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, other really dangerous industries are logging and fishing and agricultural work. And agricultural work is exempted from OSHA in the same way that agricultural work was exempted from the National Labor Relations Act. You know, I mean, farm states and farm senators have an awful lot of power in our government.
Well, the original argument for that was you've got the family farm and, you know, little
yeah.
Johnny and little Ralph, you know, have to do their chores in the morning and before they go to school, and you don't want an OSHA inspector looking over their shoulders, and you don't want them to get busted for violating the child safety laws or labor laws because it's a family farm. And that's the rationale that they used, and that rationale is now being used by multi-billion dollar multinational corporations with hundreds of thousands of employees to make sure that those employees have no protections.
Exactly. Exactly. These were laws that the rationale was kind of questionable in the first place, and it certainly has no basis now. But they're not in a lot of danger from being watched by OSHA inspectors. According to what I have here, at current staff and inspection levels, it would take OSHA 108 years to inspect each workplace under its jurisdiction once. So these business people are not exactly being harassed. If OSHA inspectors come back more than once, it's almost certainly because they're doing something terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, you know, I mean, in the best possible world with the best possible regulation and enforcement, they're still with. Inspectors are not the first line of defense for workers.
No, the workers themselves are.
The workers themselves are.
Right. As we've seen with these mine disasters, these
right.
workers could have, and in fact have spoken out about the problems but lacking a union. I mean, the United Mine Workers Union has had its back broken, frankly, by
yeah.
all the bankruptcies of these giant mining companies who basically they just use bankruptcy to get rid of the union, get rid of the pension obligations, and then transfer the mine ownership. You know, I'll give you yours, I'll give you mine, and you give me yours. Let's
mm-hmm.
just swap mines. We'll both declare bankruptcy, and then we'll swap properties, and then we both start up all over again.
Yeah, and that was the protection the workers had, and they don't. A son of one of the miners killed at the Sago mine said on the Today Show, "We have no protection for our workers. We need to get the United Mine Workers back in the coal mines to protect against these safety violations."
They let him say that on television?
On our NBC, semi-official network, they
wow.
let him say it.
I'm impressed.
Yes, it's kind of extraordinary.
Yeah. So we have just a minute to go here, Alec. We're speaking with Alec Dubrow, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org. Alec, what do you see as the biggest story in the labor world out there right now that people need to be paying attention to?
Well, I think right now the issue is coming up is it's going to be the big story from now until November is it's not specifically union, but it is going to be the elections. Mm-hmm. In other words, unions have little chance in the public sphere on the national level if both houses of Congress, the courts, and the White House are controlled by a party which has an avowed hatred of unions.
Okay.
So it's going to be in various degrees and with various tactics, how do we deal with this election? How do we effectively deal with the election? And, you know, right now there are many discussions going on among labor and their allies as to what is going to be most effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I will keep you abreast of the story as time goes on.
Great. Good speaking with you. Alec Dubrow, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, www.ilcaonline.org. Alec, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. Dewey in Georgia on the line. Hey, Dewey, welcome to the program.
Much for having me, and I've been monitoring the program on the phone here for a while, and the last gentleman who was on talking about labor, of course the president and the administration is well aware of OSHA. He plans to visit the small Wisconsin village of OSHA this winter and take a little ski vacation. And,
there you
of course, go. And he's well within the Alberto Gonzalez, you know, AG is his title, AG, Alberto Gonzalez. What could be more, you know?
Yeah, of course. That's why they had to pick him. They had to pick him.
He's a brilliant man. And I just almost have to wear sunglasses to watch him on TV.
Yeah.
But what I'm calling about, sir, is a serious matter of a journalist making threats in front of a bunch of college students in Little Rock, Arkansas, that she thought that the best thing that could happen to the United States Supreme Court would be for someone to put some rat poison in Justice Stevens' suit.
Hmm.
Can you imagine?
Well, it sounds like a crime for which a person would be arrested if they were a liberal and they made such a suggestion. I'm assuming, though, that this must have been a conservative or this person would be under the custody of the Secret Service right now.
I'm not sure on what liberal or conservative means. This lady has an Adam's apple the size of a baseball. She's a bleach blonde anorexic poster child by the name of Ann Coulter.
Yes, I have met Ann Coulter.
I'm sorry, sir. I know that you have her poster on your wall, and I don't mean to offend. And
I appreciate that, and in fact, I keep waiting to meet the person who can tell me that they knew Ann back when she was a man, because I'm convinced at one point she was.
I had those same thoughts, sir, but I wasn't going to say that.
I've met her in person twice, and I'm telling you, it's just, and there's nothing, you know, nothing wrong with people being transsexuals. I have a dear friend who is a transsexual, actually.
No.
But it's Ann Coulter, but when folks like Ann Coulter, you know, go out and make a grand display of their morality, well, don't get me started. Anyhow.
Well, she is a moral. She has a moral authority. I wouldn't have known of this if it had not been for. And we have an extremely right wing newspaper here in the city of Albany, Georgia. This is where the Vice President Dick Cheney comes to quail hunt.
Mm-hmm.
He hunts on the plantation that's owned by Victoria's Secret.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, yeah, so they have to take up all the catalogs when he comes. You know, his heart is a little weak. And,
yes.
Could you imagine Lynn, the former labor secretary and some of those frillies from that catalog.
No. But I can imagine Dick Cheney's wife with her steamy novels finding inspiration in them. Yeah.
You know, Dick was the person who was Secretary of Defense when our troops, our Marines in Lebanon, got killed in their sleep.
Yes.
That was his brilliant move to put all those troops in that one building.
On Reagan's watch.
On President Reagan's watch. He was the...
And then they cut and run.
Well, the troops were mostly killed. They couldn't run.
No, but I mean, we moved everybody else out of Lebanon.
We couldn't protect them.
Yeah.
And civil wars shouldn't be our business.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Dewey, you make a good point, and I appreciate the call. It's good to hear from you.
I appreciate what you guys are doing, and tell Mr. Franken hello. I just love his work.
Okay, will do. Thanks a lot for the smile. Good to hear from you. David in Blaine, Washington on the line. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you again. You know, unchecked power is the foundation of tyranny. Would you agree?
Yes.
And to allow President Cheney and Bush to continue to frame, you know, their blatant breaking of the Constitution with their lies and corruption is unbelievable. And this phony hearing that Specter is chairing is just mocking our whole system of our own version of democracy.
Well, Lindsey Graham, I mean, it's amazing. The Republicans are going after them. This is what Lindsey Graham said a few minutes ago in one of the hearings. I don't have the audio of it, but I've got a transcript. He said, it seems to me that when Congress in 78 set up the FISA law, they took into account the president's inherent authority under Article 2. They considered it, and they decided that the FISA court is the exclusive means of conducting surveillance on domestic persons in the collection of foreign intelligence. They considered your arguments, and they ruled on the matter. So if we buy your argument that the president's inherent authority means that he can bypass FISA, then wouldn't the president also have the authority under Article 2 to set aside the anti-torture statute that we recently passed,
right,
if he thought it impeded the war-making powers? And Alberto Gonzalez says, that's not what we're doing here. I don't think that's where we are. And so it's stuttering.
Can you please, because Specter isn't allowing the committee to show the Bush clip of him. Remember what Bush was saying about wiretapping and that they, I can't remember the full thing, but.
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed.
That's the clip you're talking about. No, they won't
let that over and over because Specter isn't allowing that clip to be shown.
Yeah, I know, and I will play it again. David, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks.
It's good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. Drop by our live chat room at TomHartmann.com. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We shall return.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. Well, in the armies, they ceased advancing because the people held their ear. Well, in the shepherds, and the soldiers, will they laid beneath the stars?
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Time for our best of the rest of the news segment. Every Monday afternoon, we try and get a couple of folks, pundits from the news, folks out there on the, particularly in the internet, who have their finger on the pulse of what's going on. And so this week we have Mark Morano, senior writer for the Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com, a conservative website, and Mark Carlin, the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com, one of the largest progressive websites. And Mark, welcome to the program.
Which Mark? But thank you.
Yeah, there you go. And the other Mark, welcome to the program. Mark Carlin. Mark Carlin, I can't hear you.
Only one Mark made it here, so thank you. This is Mark Morano.
Yeah. Alex has got to go hit a mix minus button here someplace, and so we will have Mark Carlin with us in just a moment. But Mark Morano, Mark Carlin, you there?
Tim, good afternoon, Tim.
Yeah. Good afternoon. Glad to have you with us. So we have Mark Morano with CNS News and Mark Carlin. Let's start with you, Mark Morano. What the illegal wiretapping without warrants, Gonzalez testifying or sort of testifying, he's not under oath before Congress. What's your take on all this?
Well, this is an issue, oddly enough, that either is or should be dividing conservatives. Now, you have many people who call themselves conservatives who are loyal, more loyal to the GOP than they are to, say, conservative principles, who see absolutely no problem with this, think it is absolutely fine that we're in a war on terror, that the president shouldn't even be questioned on this, this is a national security issue. And then you have other conservatives who are actually very uncomfortable with this. Actually, Ron Paul, congressman from Texas, more of a libertarian conservative, and others have expressed severe reservations about this and have questioned why the Bush administration has not there's a law which actually allows them to get these warrants, which takes only 72 hours to request a warrant, and they've overridden that. So this is an issue that's actually dividing the conservative movement. And it's an issue that these hearings we've already had on record, Arlen Specter wanting to look into this. This could cause a heap of trouble for the Bush administration.
And yet, Mark Morano, the chairman of the committee, Arlen Specter, will not allow the videotape of Alberto Gonzalez lying when he was during his confirmation hearings. I'll characterize it as lying. He certainly wouldn't. Saying, oh, we would never do that back a year ago. And will not allow the videotape of George W. Bush when he came out, and he said...
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so.
Now, Dianne Feinstein asked Alberto Gonzalez about that, and he basically mumbled. So, you know, what's the deal here? It seems to me that this thing is just a dog and pony show that's not going to go anywhere. What do you think, Mark?
Well, I think, as in most hearings in Capitol Hill, most in these high-profile investigations, and, of course, you have a Republican senator, Arlen Specter, and you have a Republican president. The same thing happens under Democratic administrations. I don't know where this is going to – where it's going to turn out, but I think – this is a larger question of, are people comfortable giving this president these kind of powers when again, within 72 hours, he can get request these under the Foreign Intelligence Services Act, FISA. They can request these kind of warrants to do that. And the Bush administration is, I guess, saying that's too onerous. And I think if you look at a review, only 5 were ever turned down out of some 18,000 requests put before the FISA court. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of conservatives, although I would say it's hard to say because partisanship sometimes rises above conservatism.
Sure.
And liberalism, the same thing. Partisanship will rise above liberalism.
So Mark Carlin, editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com, I'm wondering your take on all this.
It's quite odd. Mark and I are normally on different sides of the fence, but I think he's stated the case quite well. I would add that I don't think Arlen Specter is quite what he makes himself out to be. He did, and I think this is a very, very crucial moment, before the hearings began, kind of ramrodded through that the Attorney General of the United States, we're talking about the highest law enforcement official in the land, did not have to testify under oath. And indeed, Alberto Gonzalez was not sworn in. And the Democrats objected, and on a quick party line vote, since the Republicans aren't majority by 10-8 majority, supported Specter that Gonzalez didn't have to testify under oath.
Go ahead.
And I think it's very important to remember that when Cheney and Bush, when Bush wouldn't speak to the 9/11 commission alone, he had to have Cheney in the room, that neither of them testified under oath, that when Condoleezza Rice testified before the 9/11 commission, she wouldn't testify under oath. So we have the Bush administration, including the highest law enforcement official in the land, not testifying under oath and being protected by the Republican majority, so he, in essence, would not put himself in jeopardy of being later charged with perjury.
Yeah.
I think this is an amazing precedent, and what we're basically saying, what the highest law enforcement official in the land of the United States is saying to Americans who go into courtrooms where judges tell them that they have to testify under oath, they can say, the Attorney General of the United States will not testify under oath. Why should I?
Yeah. Mark Carlin, nearly half of Iraqis polled, 80% of the Shia, including 80% of the Shia, 60% of the Sunnis, smaller percent for the Kurds. Nearly over half, though, of Iraqis polled actually favor attacks on U.S. troops. And more than half of Americans think that Bush lied us into a war. Isn't it time to get out?
I think that the statistics you just stated speak for themselves. The issue of why there is an outrage in the United States is one of the most perplexing factors that I think is before the country. I think it's in large part to the media and to the business-as-usual tone of the hearings this morning. Although Alberto Gonzalez was probed quite heavily, we have to remember that this wasn't the only violation of the law that he is being suspected of. There were emails that were destroyed before he issued his order to the White House regarding Plain Gate to not destroy the documents, and he waited to issue that order.
24 hours.
He wrote the memo that gave the rationale for torturing people, even though he says that we don't torture people. He was the architect, in large part, behind the whole wiretapping episode. And there's even more that he was involved with the removal of a prosecutor who is about to indict Abramoff in relation to some hijinks in Guam in 2002. So when you say, you know, why isn't there more of an uproar? If the Iraqis don't want us, if the Americans don't want to be spending $100,000 a minute in Iraq that could go toward schools, that could go toward health care, that could go toward Medicare in the United States at a time Bush is cutting these back, why isn't there an outrage? I think because in Washington and in the media, there's an attitude that, you know, business is as usual, and America is ahead of the pundits in Washington and ahead of the politicians in Washington. I might say both in the Republican and Democratic Party.
Well, that's actually, Tom, to go back to your original question, should we get out? It's not that simple. Even if, as many of you have acknowledged, that the weapons of mass destruction and the threat of Saddam Hussein were either bad intelligence or intentionally manipulated, as some have charged, we are there now, and we can't just pull out, as some, i.e., John Murtha has suggested, and even now Pat Buchanan on the right is suggesting, essentially.
Well, it's not even now. Pat Buchanan suggested that 2 years ago. He wrote a book about it called Where the Right Went Wrong, which is
fairly decent
book.
He was referring to, he just came out with a new column, I guess, 2 days ago, on Friday. But this is a situation where, you know, the people keep talking about the Vietnamization. One of George Bush's biggest mistakes in this whole war, and the Iraq War, was the same mistake that LBJ made. You cannot conduct a war overseas where we have a daily death toll with the news media reporting it and then go on and act as though there's nothing happening. And this is what George Bush did for most of 2005. And you had this vacuum, and the vacuum was filled by sites like BuzzFlash, by the Democrats, by the people who opposed this
war. Come on, Mark. You can't blame the media for this thing. What's going on right now is that we had a successful war. We had a successful invasion. Sure. We toppled a government, and then we began to occupy a country. If Mexico decided that they were going to depose George W. Bush because he was a threat to the world, he had weapons of mass destruction, and he'd become a mad dictator, and Mexico occupied the United States, I suspect that all three of us in this conversation would be out there with our guns saying, you guys get out of this country. And the Iraqi people are saying the same thing.
Well, and I might add that the Iraqi people, according to Rumsfeld, according to Wolfowitz, according to Pearl, who suddenly popped up again saying bomb Iran, according to Bush, were supposed to greet us with flowers. We achieved the initial goals that Bush said were the goals, to remove Saddam and to eliminate weapons of mass destruction. There were no weapons of mass destruction. We removed Saddam.
Well,
what the heck are we still doing there?
It would dishonor all the servicemen who died if we just pulled out without a plan, as John Murtha wanted to do.
No, I'm sorry. Having more
rejected, and it's not about, it's about how we do this the right way and not make the same mistake we made in Vietnam where all our work.
Mark Morano, Cybercast News Service, CNS News. Mark Carlin, the editor and founder of BuzzFlash, BuzzFlash.com. Thank you, gentlemen, both of you, for being with us today. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, and let us not forget.
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, it requires a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Witt in Scottsdale, Arizona. You
Hi,
think
Tom,
George is doing just
program.
A fine job, Witt?
Hi, Tom. Love your program.
Thank you.
Just called in because I was tuning in and dropping out, and I wanted to respond to some hysterical things I heard one of your callers say about me, not to mention what the things you have to say about our honorable President George Bush, who was elected twice legitimately.
Okay.
You still haven't gotten over that fact. But you think
Says,
who actually is a gangster, is really a good guy because you buy into his popular socialist rhetoric, which makes him popular in a poor, pathetic country that he rules, that has always been backwater nation. So long.
Are you talking about Hugo Chavez?
Yeah, Hugo
Chavez
is a gangster. George Bush is the legitimate leader of the best country on the planet Earth that happens to be engaged in a just war in Iraq right now, of which Hillary Clinton and John Forbes Heinz Kerry still support. But if George Bush lied us into war, why hasn't John Forbes Heinz Kerry or Hillary Clinton done anything about it? Because that, to me, would warrant, you know, the ultimate punishment, if you know what I'm saying, if you lied us into war in Iraq.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, but I am. John Kerry has come out against the war, and
he has,
but he hasn't renounced his vote.
Another day, it depends on who he's talking to.
Yeah, he hasn't renounced his vote, and neither has Hillary Clinton. And I agree with you. I think that they're both mistaken in doing that.
You're not actually engaging me in the larger point. If George Bush is a gangster like Saddam Hussein and is in Iraq for stealing oil, he deserves.
Oh, I never suggested George Bush was in Iraq for stealing.
Impeachment. But anyway.
Witt, I never suggested George Bush was in Iraq for stealing oil. I suggested that George Bush. Witt, you got to at least let me respond to your points if you're going to throw them out here.
Okay,
I suggested that George Bush went into Iraq for political gain, not for oil. The oil was a bonus.
Okay.
But what he told his biographer, and he told his biographer right straight up, but it's on the public record, in 1999, before he ran for president, that if he ever became president and if he ever got a chance to attack Iraq, he wouldn't waste the political capital the way his father did by only having a 100-hour war. He would have, and he would use that political capital to get his entire agenda done. And he pointed out that no president has ever failed to be reelected during time of war. I am convinced that George W. Bush ginned up this war in 2002 in order to help the Republicans take the Senate back in the election of 2002 and carried it over the year 2004 so that he could get himself elected in the year 2004. And frankly, I'm convinced that before the election of 2006, he's going to pull something else out of his hat.
Like I said, hysterical. I wish I had time to engage you in all those finer points that you just responded with, but why didn't you ask Cindy Sheehan not to lie to you? Because the very first thing she said on last Thursday, was a lie when she said she took off her jacket because she was warm. She wore that T-shirt to make a statement in the United States Congress when nobody else did except for another person that did get drummed out of there as well.
Yeah, well, she said she intended to make a statement. She said that she was sitting up there in the gallery and she thought the camera might pan by and see the T-shirt.
Michael Moore's website says, I wore the shirt to make a statement.
Right.
What right does she have to do that? Is there no circumstance where people don't
she has the right
have
to do
right
that
to
under
wear
the first
a T-shirt out of respect for the people's house, get dressed up, and don't wear a shirt that says, I hate George Bush, he killed my son.
Witt,
okay.
if you can calm down for just
right.
a second, may I respond to your point? I don't disagree with you that it is not the very best of manners to show up at a formal event not dressed formally. However, the right by which she wore that T-shirt, and the reason, and this has now been acknowledged by the Capitol Police, who have apologized to her. I'm sure you caught that on the news.
No, it's politically correct.
The right by which she had the right to wear that T-shirt is the First Amendment. We have a free speech zone. It's called the United States of America.
Oh, my God. If I went into church and wore a shirt that said, Joseph Ratzinger is a Nazi, would the priest have the right to draw me out of there?
Sure, because it's private property.
Despicable.
Sure, because it's private property.
Thing as free speech.
The United States House of Representatives is not private property. It's public property. There are different rules for public property and private property. If you come over to my house wearing a T-shirt that I consider objectionable, I have the right to toss you out.
George Bush had every right not to have anybody in the audience saying, I hate George Bush, he killed my son, T-shirts on, which is basically what the shirt represents.
Okay. I got your point, Whit, and you make it well. And I think I've made mine. Armin in Sarasota, Florida on the line. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind? We got about a minute left.
Let me go quick. This guy, first off, doesn't believe in the Carlyle Group and Iran-Contra never happened, so that takes care of his case in point. I'd like to say something. With George Orwell Bush's war on terrorism, he's created a totally new public bureaucracy of scareism.
Sure.
And if globalism is good enough for the working middle class that built this country and fights the wars, why isn't it good enough for the CEO thugs that have run this country and the middle class in a ditch?
Yeah, let's outsource some of the CEOs.
I vote for Japanese and Korean CEOs and a Canadian-style health care system for all Americans. That would be meaningful social security reform.
There you go. Well said, Armin. Well said. And let's bring some of those jobs back home. Armin, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Yeah, there you go. Great to hear from you. It's always good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, conservative Andrew Bernstein claims environmentalism causes eco-terrorism. We'll discuss that. Greg Watson will explain the obstacles to renewable energy. That and more in your calls on tomorrow's Tom Hartman program, The Democracy Zone. And remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.